This evening, we will fulfill all five facets of our Holy Land ministry and forum. And the five facets are prayer, study, engagement, advocacy, and giving. We focus on these five areas in an effort to foster understanding, peace, justice, and reconciliation in the Holy Land. A key aspect of our pursuit of peace with justice is to produce these kinds of events monthly that are ecumenical and interfaith in nature. However, it is also our desire to include all people seeking peace, regardless of their spirituality, because human rights, justice, quality of life, and equality are not limited to specific religious traditions. This evening, we're here to provide information that may be new to you. We're here to motivate you, to encourage your participation in positive action and advocacy. Status quo in the Holy Land is not, cannot be considered a viable option. This evening is about mobilizing all people, regardless of race, creed, or religion. It is not about hopelessness, it is about hope. It's about nonviolent pursuit of peace with justice, peace with equality, peace with integrity for all the people of Palestine and Israel and their neighbors. The personal experiences you're going to hear are not commodities to be advertised. They are offered for your thoughtful consideration, your reflection. They are meant to stimulate change, to make the world a better place for all. The life stories shared this evening are very personal, yet they are not exceptional. They are commonplace. They are not unusual. However, they are much different than most of the sensationalism distributed by popular media. I consider each of the women to be remarkable and very courageous, each in their own way. Devoted leaders in the cause of peace with justice and human rights. We will begin with Dr. Ahlam Mutasib. Ahlam is a Muslim Palestinian born in Hebron, Palestine, approximately 23 miles south of Jerusalem. She lived there until 1998 when she was awarded a Fulbright scholarship and came to America to pursue advanced degrees. She earned her doctorate in mass communication at the University of Memphis, and Dr. Mutasib is professor of communication studies at Cal State San Bernardino. Let's give someone from Riverside and San Bernardino a good San Diego welcome.
For me to come here tonight, and I would like to thank you all for attending our presentations. Those presentations are supposed to be about our personal stories as, you know, women seeking justice in the world. And I am Palestinian, have a very compelling personal story. However, I'm also a professor and researcher, and my major area of research is really Palestinian refugees' narratives of diaspora. And I'm not a refugee, by the way, so I chose tonight, actually, to focus on their story. Because I would like to give some voice to those who are marginalized in society. In the United States, because mainly of the media and its lack of portrayal or fair portrayal of the conflict in the Middle East, that many Americans actually lack a deep understanding of this issue. Therefore, I'm going to give you a quick historical narrative. So let me start by talking a little bit about some of the myths that have been used very successfully, actually, by the Israeli propaganda to talk about or to create a certain discourse, actually, about the conflict in the Middle East. And the first one is usually that this is a religious conflict mainly, of course, as portrayed between Palestinian Muslims and Israeli Jews. And I totally disagree with this. It's not religious at all. Actually, if we look at the Palestinian population before the Zionist movement, before everything happened there, it was a population formed of Muslims, Christians, and Jews. For example, Christians used to be close to 25% of the, and still around that percentage, but unfortunately, of course, dispersed around the world now, of the Palestinian population. The Jewish community or minority was close to 3%. So I will start by saying this is not really a religious conflict, though it is usually disguised as a religious conflict. If I may, I actually would like to describe it as another form of classic colonialism, where usually, you know, European forces come and occupy the land somewhere in the world. In this case, of course, we are talking about the Middle East and in particular the Palestinian land. And this problem was really created in Europe. Unfortunately, Palestinians had to pay the price for this problem, which is the persecution of Jews, which was a very unfortunate, you know, historical event. However, as I said, the Palestinians had nothing to do with this conflict. As a result of this persecution, the creation of the Zionist movement came about. And I will quickly just talk about the Zionist movement, which was mainly promoted and really created by Theodor Herzl, who is actually thought of as the father of Zionism in its modern form. And just to actually confirm the fact that it's not a religious conflict, he was actually a secular Jew. The first Zionist conference that took place in Switzerland in Basel was actually supposed to have taken place in Munich in Germany. This was in 1897. However, many of the reformist and Orthodox Jewish groups in Germany totally rejected the Zionist idea at that time and refused to facilitate holding the conference in Germany, so it was changed into Switzerland, where it took place, and this was like the official kickoff of the Zionist movement with its agenda. Of course, its agenda was not static. It changed over the years. However, it started with a very simple idea, which is founding a national Jewish homeland for all Jews from around the world. I don't have a problem with that. However, when they decided on where to incubate, you know, this homeland, there was a debate, actually, in the Zionist movement between several countries, including Argentina and Uruguay. And other countries, and then at the end they said, well, the easiest one would be Palestine because of the historical roots of Palestine or historical Palestine to Jordan. Also, the political atmosphere at that time and later on facilitated the idea of actually creating such a national homeland for the Jews in Palestine. In the history of the Zionist movement, there was a very interesting change that I will revisit later, but I'm just going to point to it now. Which happened in 1942 when the Zionist movement actually split into two camps. One still supported the original idea of the creation of a Jewish homeland, and a new, more extreme, actually, strand of Zionism that actually called or pushed for the creation of a national Jewish state, which is, of course, a totally different story. And the preparation became more militant and more aggressive until it led to 1948, the creation of the State of Israel, and of course the ethnic cleansing and genocide of the Palestinian people. Now let's look again, a closer look at the British role, because it was really a very crucial role. Without it, you know, I don't think the Zionist movement could have went anywhere. In 1917, the Balfour Declaration, which was outrageous. Balfour, or Lord Balfour, was the Foreign Secretary of England, United Kingdom at that time, and he gave himself and the British government the luxury and the right, actually, to give Palestine, this was before even the British colonized Palestine, to give it as a national homeland for the Jews from around the world, as I said, taking into consideration the rights of the minorities living in Palestine, which was outrageous because the Arabs were not a minority at all. You know, they were the majority, actually. In 1918, British officially colonized Palestine. They called it the British Mandate of Palestine, a very nice, politically correct term, which was actually given credibility through the League of Nations, which was the body that preceded the United Nations. You know, it was used to be called League of Nations, and then it was dissolved and changed into the United Nations that we know of today. So actually, the United Nations played two major episodes in the history of Palestine by really legitimizing the first colonization and the second colonization of Palestine, unfortunately. So between 1918 and 1948, Britain actually encouraged immigration of the Jews from all around the world to Palestine and facilitated their acquisition of the land by all means possible, whether buying it or forcing its people out, etc. However, this didn't really succeed in creating a majority of Jews in Palestine or a majority of land acquisition by the Jews in Palestine. In 1948, the number of Jews jumped from around 55,000 into a little bit more than 500,000. And land acquisition only jumped from 2% into 6.7%. So until 1948, until the day of the creation of the State of Israel, the Jews owned only 6.7% of the Palestinian land. And they were still a minority among the population. However, look at another really outrageous decision or resolution by the United Nations, which is the resolution number 181, which actually gave the majority of the population, Arabs, only 45% of the land, while they owned about 93%, more than 93% of the land, and gave the rest for the Jews. Usually I hear in the Israeli propaganda that, well, Palestinians were given, you know, part of the, they didn't want it, you know, they fought that, you know, they rejected that, and now they want it back. I was like, if you actually were in their place, would you actually give your land and just get out of the land and give it to someone else? Would you do that in your houses and your lands and your country? Of course. I mean, it was just nothing more logical than to do that, to reject resolution number 181. Until 1948, it didn't succeed. However, with the establishment of the of Israel, which was, you know, based on really several gangs that were heavily armed, that fought Palestinians and simply kicked them out of the land, and I will talk about the issue of the refugees in a minute, slowly the plan succeeded. And if you look in the year 2000, you will see how much the land acquisition succeeded and how much the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians succeeded and is still succeeding. I mean, it's still going on, and it's still with the creation of the wall, with this more and more settlements, what is happening in Gaza, all of these things, the bypass roads, if you've ever heard about them. So at the end, we actually have a successful plan of ethnic cleansing that is now actually mounting to a more of a genocide and has been actually happening in the West Bank and Gaza lately. These are some pictures of what happened to the Palestinians in 1948. But, you know, what happened is a series of massacres in at the hands of those gangs like Stern, Haganah, Ergon, and what they did, they were not really interested in killing as many Palestinians as possible. That was not the idea. The idea was to scare and to implant fear in as many Palestinians as possible and force them out of the land. The land was really the major issue here. So this is what they did by doing several massacres. Of course, one of them is the infamous Deir Yassin, which I will show you in a little bit. A big number of the Palestinian population were farmers and villagers who worked mainly in the land, and that's why they have this strong connection to the land. Couldn't defend themselves, couldn't defend their children or, you know, their families, so they actually were forced to flee and live in tents and refugee camps, and that led to the creation of one of the largest refugee issues or problems in the whole world, which is still going on until today. And this picture actually is from a very interesting book. It's by the Israeli historian reformist historian, Ilan Pape, in his book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. The first one on top left is a picture of the Haganah fighters who took actually part in those massacres. This is an excerpt from the New York Times, actually, in which they describe the massacre. It says, Jerusalem, April 9, a combined force of Ergun Zvi Leumi and the Stern Group, Jewish extremist underground forces, captured the Arab village of Deir Yassin on the western outskirts of Jerusalem today. In house-to-house fighting, the Jews killed more than 200 Arabs, half of them women and children. Now, the interesting thing is, nowadays we see very similar events in Gaza, for example. Very, very similar, you know, the mass killing of mainly civilian populations, just another episode of the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. As I said, this led to the creation of the Palestinian refugee problem. Of course, I have the number here, which is maybe the like the average number, which is 800,000. But we have numbers as low as 750 and as high as actually 910. And even UNRWA's numbers go closer to 1 million refugees who were displaced from their homeland. Of course, those people were out of fear, just left and ran away, taking nothing with them. So depending on where you lived in Palestine, you immigrated. So if you lived in the north, most likely you ended up going to Lebanon. If you lived in the middle areas, most likely you went to Syria or to Jordan. In the south, to Egypt, etc. And some people went through the sea to other places like Europe, some actually as far as Iraq later on. To give you an example of what happened as well as in form of the ethnic cleansing, between 400 and 450 Palestinian towns and villages were totally destroyed, especially those villages that resisted, that fought back the Haganah, Ergun, and Stern gang members or terrorists, as they were actually termed by the British forces at that time. Some images of what happened to those refugees who dispersed around the world, living in tents, yearning to go back, to return. Many of them in Lebanon, they keep their land deeds. They didn't really take much with them because they thought they would go back. But most of them took the deeds of the land, the keys. That's why it became very symbolic, actually, in the creation of the problem, and was very helpful also in maintaining a collective national identity for those refugees away from their homelands. Gaza, of course, I'm assuming most of you have heard something about Gaza. Unfortunately, of course, the U.S. mainstream media was just totally awful in its really coverage of the conflict. Gaza has been actually under severe attack and war by Israel that was, of course, used, according to some sources, about half of its military munition, which is the fourth or the fifth most powerful in the world. They used half of that on a small strip, you know, the most densely populated region in the world. In the whole world, you have more people in one small area than anywhere else. Last year, just before Christmas, Israel invaded Gaza. And it announced its ceasefire after 3 weeks. So it took them 3 weeks, and they were in really in a hurry, you know, so that's maybe why they used a lot of their military might, because they wanted to finish that operation, which they called Cast Lead, before the inauguration of the new president. However, the Israeli army killed about 1,330 Palestinians, mainly civilians. About 450 were children. They destroyed more than 22,000 houses. Can you imagine in 3 weeks, you destroyed 22,000 houses, and those people live in extended families. You sometimes have the uncles, the aunts, the grandparents, etc. So this led to the displacement of a huge number of people, estimated at about 50,000. They destroyed more. About 80% of agriculture in Gaza, which, you know, it's again, a place that really depends to a great extent on agriculture, because they are under siege, total siege by Israel, air, land, and sea. Even fishermen find it very hard to go and fish. They violated international law and committed war crimes, and they are actually, this is according to Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and even all Israeli human rights groups also accused their government of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. Those include shelling every civilian institution. I mean, we are not talking about military posts or something like that. We are talking about ministries, the parliament, universities, mosques. They destroyed the major university in Gaza totally. Schools, anything you can imagine. Even United Nations schools were shelled 3 times. They used prohibited weapons like white phosphorus bombs, and those are not necessarily banned by international law. However, you can't use them in civilian areas. You can use them only with troops as to have a, like smoke screen only to cover the troops when they go. DIM, have you ever heard of DIM or DIM? Well, it was invented in the United States and it's still under experimentation in the United States. It's still not well known. I mean, it's still kind of secretive because we don't know much about it. But from the research I did, it basically does a lot of very tiny insertions in the body. You know, it doesn't really cause any big explosions. It causes those small incisions in the body, and you can tell when the doctor said when they were receiving. Receiving injuries in the hospital and treating them, they wouldn't see anything. I mean, people were dying, but they didn't know why. But then they discovered that those are very tiny shrapnels that you can't see them. They insert the body, and they try to kill without explosions or destruction. And they would treat the people if they see anything and then, you know, stabilize them and put them aside, and they would come back in a few hours, and they are dead. When they open, you know, the body, they find, you know, they would find all these internal injuries and bleeding that were caused by this specific type of weapons. And that makes me really suspicious. This is my theory. I don't have proof of it. That also there were several reasons for waging the war, the latest war in Gaza. But I think one of them is really experimental, to experiment with those new weapons. Unfortunately, on the Palestinian population. They use cluster bombs and summary executions of civilians, including even children. There were cases of children shot in the head, for example, from a very short range, like babies. And I have a testimony by a doctor, he's a Norwegian doctor. And in the interview here with one of the American channels, actually, he says he saw horrors.
A bit more than an hour ago, the Israelis bombed the central fruit market in Gaza City, and we had a mass influx of about 50 injured and between 10 and 15 killed. At the same time, they bombed an apartment house with children playing on the roof, and we had a lot of children also. So this is really like a scene from the Dante's Inferno. It's like hell here now, and it's been bombing all night. Up till now, close to 500 people have been killed. And the number of casualties is getting to 2,500, of which 50% are children and women.
Are your hospitals reaching capacity? Can you deal with these people?
We have been doing surgery around the clock. I just talked to one of my colleagues in the ICU who has not been sleeping for 3 days, and the hospital is completely overcrowded. We're running 6-7 ORs, and there are injuries you just don't want to see in this world. Children coming in with open abdomens and legs cut off. We just had a child we had to amputate both legs and the arm. And the only crime they have done is being civilians, the Palestinians living in Gaza. The relief now is not more doctors and more drugs. The relief now is to stop the bombing immediately. This cannot go on. It's a disaster.
You've talked about the civilians, the women, the children, the men who aren't involved in this, but are you also getting casualties that are Hamas fighters?
To be honest, we came on New Year's Eve in the morning. I've seen one military person among the 10 we have, I mean, 100 that we have seen and treated. So anybody who tries to portray this as sort of a clean war against another army are lying. This is an all-out war against the civilian Palestinian population in Gaza, and we can prove that with the numbers. And you have to remember that the average age of the Gaza inhabitants is 17 years. It's a very young population, and 80% are living below the poverty limit of UN. So this is a poor and very young people. and they are able to escape absolutely nowhere because they cannot flee like other populations can in wartime because they are fenced in and they are in a cage. So they're bombing 1.5 million people in a cage. And young people, poor people, and, you know, you cannot separate between the civilians and the fighters in such a situation.
I apologize for some of the images, but believe me, those are very sanitized images. I mean, if you, you know, check the images, the actual, what was happening, you will be totally disturbed by the actual damage happened. Okay, those are just pictures. I told you I have better ones of white phosphorus bombs and shelling. And this is the United Nations school that was shelled, one of the three that were shelled, actually. Even the food storage place, you know, in Gaza was shelled, the United Nations one. So as you can see, people are fleeing. It was packed with civilians who were displaced, didn't have any shelter. They were sheltering in the school. And I heard one of the, you know, I was listening to one of the interviews, and the doctor said they opened the wound and they, you know, put down the fire and they treat the burn. But then when they open it again the next day to treat it, this is one of the problems with the white phosphorus, it start burning up again on the body of the injured. It's so hard to put down, you know. There's another video, but I don't have time. It's called The Killing Zone. You can look at it on YouTube. It talks about Gaza before, because people think it only happened, the genocide happened only lately. Actually, this has been happening over and over and over, especially in Gaza. So I will end up here, actually. Basically, I call in that action plan to support the Palestinians in their struggle to boycott Israeli goods and also cultural boycott and divestment from Israel, to put enough pressure on Israel to stop that, to take those people who were accountable for all the suffering and misery to court and actually take them to The Hague. It was so easy to do this to Omar Bashir in Sudan, but it's Israel has been doing even more evil things over the years and has never been accountable in front of the international community. Thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate my time with you.